12 Who Shaped San Diego, a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego.
He was hard with himself. He demanded a great deal of himself, but in dealing with his brethren, he was very charitable, very gentle, very kind and sympathetic.
Father Junipero Serra was instrumental in establishing the first permanent European settlement in California. That was here in San Diego in the year 1769. He came to San Diego after a long period of missionary service in Mexico, and went on to establish 9 missions along the coast of California, from San Diego to San Francisco. His life is the subject of this second program in the series, 12 Who Shaped San Diego. I'm Peter Hamlin, and joining me as San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for these programs, Dr. Claire Crane. Claire, we left our last program in the year 1542. That was the year that Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo sailed into San Diego Harbor. Now, how soon was it before the Spanish again turned their attention to the area that was first discovered for Spain by Cabrillo?
Well, of course, they continued to be interested in it in a larger sense, but they didn't make any effort to permanently colonize it until 1768, when the plans were begun, and the colonization itself did not occur until 1769. However, in the interim, in that 150 years or so, there had been voyages along the coast. The most important, of course, was that of Vizcaino in 1602. It was important because he produced a much more accurate and detailed map than Cabrillo had done, and he renamed a great many places, and that's how we come to be called San Diego, for example. Cabrillo's initial description of this place was San Miguel, because he had come into the harbor on the Saint's Day of San Miguel, whereas Vizcaino arrived on the Saint's Day of San Diego de Alcalá, and that's why he gave it that name.
Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego, points to one prime reason for that large gap in years between Cabrillo and actual settlement.
I'd say the main reason is very simple. The Indians did not have any gold. They didn't have any jewelry. There didn't seem to be any great economic motive, and they had just experienced several failures. The Spanish had sponsored the Coronado expedition into the interior of North America, the De Soto expedition in the eastern area, and both of these expeditions had failed to produce any great wealth. So when Coronado arrived finding Indians with only baskets and a few knickknacks, they just didn't feel that it would be economically profitable.
The key figure in early colonization efforts appeared on the scene in Mexico.
Toward the latter part of the 18th century, a man by the name of José de Galvez, who was the visitador general, or we would say in English kind of an inspector general, representative of the King of Spain, Carlos III, he arrived in Mexico and was full of great plans for the expansion. And I would say he had a dual motive. One would be economic, and the second was religious, the conversion of the territory to Christianity. And then as a lever, he was able to use the Russian threat that the Russians were coming down the coast of North America, and if Spain did not follow through with their plans, the Russians may succeed. When the plans were actually made for the California move, José de Galvez was in Mexico, and it's interesting when you follow the correspondence, he wrote for permission, for authorization, but he got the plans going before he received approval. He sort of went on the idea that he would succeed in getting it, and he was aggressive himself and just believed that it was the right thing to do. He contacted a person that we've all come to know in California, Father Junipero Serra, who was in the area of Mexico, north of Mexico City, and Serra was very eager, too, to extend the Franciscan mission field. So these two went ahead with the plans.
At this time, Serra had had considerable experience in missionary work in the New World. He had traveled from Spain to Veracruz in 1749, and then to Mexico City by foot the following year. For the next 17 years, he worked as a missionary in several areas of what is now Mexico. He was to found the first mission of Upper California in San Diego, along with eight others to the north. What sort of a man was this who ventured virtually alone into an unknown area to form the foundation of our present city? For an answer, we turn to Father Francis Guest, the archivist and librarian at the Santa Barbara Mission Archive Library, where a considerable body of information on Junipero Serra is kept.
Junipero Serra was a dynamic man. Herbert Eugene Bolton, famous as a historian in California, described him as a two-fisted priest. That's a very good description. He was, in a way, a typical Spaniard in the sense that he valued greatly the virtues of fortitude and manliness, the strong virtues, the martial virtues, self-sacrifice, self-dedication. He spent himself for the Indians, for the missions, and for the service of his own brethren, the missionaries here in Upper California. That was the kind of man he was. He gave all he had all the time. He was hard with himself. He demanded a great deal of himself, but in dealing with his brethren, he was very charitable, very gentle, very kind and sympathetic. He was equally kind and patient in his treatment of the Indians. Sometimes, after the missions had been developed and Indians had been converted and were learning a Spanish way of life, some of them would disobey, perhaps even in serious matter, and punishment was administered to them. But Serra always cautioned patience and leniency where these matters were concerned. He was not severe with others, but rather was severe with himself.
Father Francis Guest. Claire, I wonder if one example of Serra's severity with himself might have been demonstrated on his walk to San Diego, which I understand he actually did the walk with considerable pain, physical pain.
Yes, this is certainly an example of the way in which Father Serra was hard upon himself. And in the biographies of Serra, his courage and his dedication and his religious zeal are revealed in the kinds of injuries that he either suffered or actually in some instances inflicted upon himself during his sermons. For instance, he sometimes, in order to illustrate the pains of hellfire, would take glowing coals and burn his chest. In regard to his leg, evidently the injury first occurred when he came to Mexico in 1749, and when the ship landed at Veracruz, and instead of riding to Mexico City, a distance of some 300 miles, he chose to walk. And on the way, he was bitten by probably a scorpion, and his leg became infected, and for the rest of his life, he suffered considerably with that. He did not really permit it to be adequately cared for, and the suffering that he endured, he regarded apparently as a kind of penance, a kind of reminder to him of his mortality and his sense of sin and so on. And he did a number of these things, suffered physical pains as part of his religious zeal. I think it's something that is perhaps difficult for us to understand in the 20th century, but it was by no means uncommon in the time in which he lived.
And I understand it was impossible to persuade him to delay the trip to San Diego, or for that matter, to refrain from walking to the extent that he did in coming to San Diego.
Yes. At one point, he finally was in so much pain, and the leg was so swollen and ulcerated that he asked one of the muleteers, that is, one of the men who took care of the mules, what he would do with a mule who had a sore leg, and the man made up some kind of a poultice, put it on Father Serra's leg, and it did relieve the pain considerably so that he was able to go on. The reason, of course, that he was very anxious to get there is that for many years he had had a great desire to bring Christianity to the Indians. As a young man, he had read about St. Francis Solano, a monk who had been canonized in 1726 after having traveled throughout South America and baptizing some 100,000 people. And Serra had this tremendous dedication and desire to do something similar to that.
Serra met when he arrived in San Diego with the Portola expedition. Roy Cook is a Native American who teaches classes in American Indian Studies at San Diego State University and Grossmont College, and his heritage has led him to a study of San Diego's early inhabitants.
People were called Kumeyaay for those that live near the cliffs. I'm sure many people here in the San Diego area are familiar with the cliffs from Torrey Pines on south through and into Mexico. Of course, this was before the time that the artificial political boundary was established, the border between the two nations as we know it. At the time, the people lived for a number of years in a very similar manner, probably at the time that they were first saw those bearded people or the people that had hair on their face. They lived in a peaceful manner with the usual individual arguments and the animosities and the bickering that goes on between individuals of the human race. But by and large, they lived without war, without massive scale of conflict. They lived in a peaceful manner. They lived in a rather good way, despite whatever neurosis may have developed because of certain things. They lived in a good way because it was a very good state. The unknown powers were very kind to the people. They lived here in pretty much of a harmonious cycle of living. They lived next to the coast when the fishing and the shell life was abundant. They moved in closer toward their gardens, really, more than farms. They were semi-agricultural before the Spanish were here. It's not well documented, but there are some indications that the people practiced a type of garden semi-agriculture, proto-agriculture.
It's interesting to guess what the Indians must have thought upon seeing the Spaniards, people of an entirely different culture, different in appearance, language, and behavior. But Roy Cook says the newcomers were expected.
I grew up at San Isabel Reservation, and I was told from my youngest days about the people were expecting someone coming up. They heard the word that something was coming up from the south. And they were anticipating. Now, they of course didn't know about the Spanish or the conquistadores or any of that sort of thing, but they knew that an important word was coming. And it's not really that clear whether this preceded the actual first contact, but they had always been waiting for someone to come. So when that they came and that they had, like so many things that we have now, interesting curiosities and technological advances and just marvelous mechanical things, they were met with a curiosity and an openness that any other group would have been met with. As many folks probably know, that generosity is almost a byword and a character trait to a point of ruination amongst many Indian groups. And as such, anyone that came would be met with generosity and openness. It was a way of life. So when the Spanish finally made it here, or who the first people finally came in contact, the people were waiting for them. They had heard the word about the religious thought and a goddess or a female form that appeared to people, and they were waiting for that word and someone to bring that word to them. So there was almost a hand in glove type of a situation, that the people were receptive and expectant, and someone came and fulfilled that that expectation.
Claire, does the notion of expectation have any correlation at all in the accounts of the missionaries?
Yes, it's very clear, very, very interesting. In the missionary records, they speak frequently of the tremendous power and drawing power and significance of religious images, the paintings that they brought with them, and statues. The Indians responded to these representations of the Virgin Mary and of the saints. Particularly, they seemed to respond to any representations of the Madonna and Child, and they would come bring their own children. A number of interesting, very touching references to that.
And Roy Cook says, at least in the beginning, the ideas brought by the missionaries to the San Diego Indians were not entirely new in some respects, or at least could be understood in terms of their existing beliefs.
There was an openness, or there was a willingness to accept new ideas, as long as they could be fitted, they could fit into their present system of belief. We found that proof or point of fact also evident as they came through the Mexican tribes, that there was a corresponding change in the religion, that there was a greater emphasis, if it was convenient to the Roman Catholic religion, on the saints, whereby the pantheism of the original spirits that had been recognized would still be revered and acknowledged, except in a parallel sort of a function. If you follow what I mean. And when they came here to California, there was already that anticipation and expectation. So there wasn't a rejection. It wasn't an animosity, but it was a welcoming of a, let us say, an organized system which didn't conflict. And until there was conscription and all other sorts of political and economic hardship, there was no reason to reject yet another wise word.
Roy Cook, who teaches American Indian Studies at San Diego State University and Grossmont College. It's interesting to compare the mission system here to the predominantly English settlement in the eastern part of the United States. Dr. Iris Engstrand points to some very sharp differences in the Spanish approach to settlement.
Well, I think the primary difference is the treatment of the Indians. The Spanish, their whole idea was to convert the Indians to Christianity, bring them into the Spanish way of life. They would become citizens of the empire. They encouraged intermarriage, whereas the English did not deal with the Indians as a part of the colonization program. In fact, if the Indians, you know, could be move to another area, that would be more satisfactory. And the English, I think the reasons that the English came were different also, which had an effect on the Indians. The English were dissenters, religious dissenters, as we all know, the Puritans who first came, and they were really interested in keeping their particular religion, their own, in keeping to themselves, their own government, and the Indians just weren't really a part of the plan. On the other hand, the Spanish would not only not send religious dissenters, you had to really prove that you were a good, faithful Catholic even to get to go to the New World, because that was their goal.
Well, I think another thing that is very different from the English system as compared to the Spanish system is that the Spanish did not have laws against racial intermarriage, as occurred very early with the English system, and it referred not only to the Indians, but later on, of course, to the blacks as well. But the Spaniards had a different approach, and particularly in California, this was true, where the concept was to make the Indians into Spanish colonial citizens themselves. The mission system was not just to bring the word of God, but to bring the whole concept of Hispanic culture, of European arts and crafts, language, literature, methods of building and doing all kinds of things. The mission system then was to function as an instrument of Spanish colonization, and the historian Herbert Bolton has detailed this in a number of articles that he wrote in connection with his histories of the Spanish borderlands.
Again, Dr. Iris Engstrand.
What Dr. Bolton was had intended to show, and I think what he did very well, was that the mission was an agent of the state, that it had a dual function. One was the conversion of the Indians, but the second was to expand the frontier and the Spanish way of life in areas that perhaps other means could not succeed. In fact, in the area of Sonora, New Mexico, they felt by sending missionaries to as the advance guard to convert the Indians, by the time the rest of the people arrived, that things would be under control. And it did work in many areas, although the missionaries suffered a number of disasters. Many were killed, but I think by example, by returning to areas where their predecessors had been killed, finally the Indians were convinced that they meant to come in peace. They would return unarmed, and I just can't help but admire some of these priests going into areas either with one companion or a very small contingent of soldiers to where thousands of Indians were. And if the priests were not able to convince them of the Spanish way of life, there was really nothing that could have been done if the Indians had decided, you know, when 1,000 Indians versus 8 Spaniards, that the Indians could not have destroyed the missions.
Although the missions functioned with the Spanish government in the colonizing effort, this period in California's history was not without its friction between the military governors and the missionaries, particularly Father Serra.
His main conflict with the governors was always he wanted to establish another mission when the governor felt that they didn't have the resources, the manpower. And when you consider the entire military force defending California in the beginning was about 60 men. I mean, this is 60 men divided among 4 presidios of San Francisco, Santa Barbara, Monterey, and San Diego. And then it took 5 to 6 or maybe 8 soldiers at each mission just for protection and as a mission guard. And so the governors were really trying to say to Serra, now look, you know, we're very limited here in manpower, and I just, you know, for the safety of the missionaries, it's not going to work. But Serra had such a drive to get the missions established that he would have done it, you know, single-handedly, saying that, you know, don't worry about it, we'll handle it. And so I think this is really the basis of the conflict between Serra and the governors.
In the conflict, who finally prevailed in the end? Whose point of view on the matter finally became the fact of the mission development?
Well, actually, the military point of view did prevail. Father Serra returned to Mexico to protest the actions of Governor Fages, who was his kind of the main source of the conflict in 1772. Although while Serra was there, they worked out sort of a system of government where they identified the roles of the governor, the military, and the religious. And Serra was able to have the one governor removed to be replaced by another man, although not Serra's choice. Sarah had wanted this Sergeant Jose Ortega, who had accompanied him on the trek from Lower California, to be the governor, but instead Fernando de Rivera y Moncada, also on the original trek, was selected. Although, as it turned out, Sarah and Rivera had conflicts the entire time. Rivera was then replaced by Felipe de Neve, with whom Sarah continued his conflict and problems. And then, ironically, Pedro Fages, the first governor that Sarah had removed, returned. And by this time, he and Sarah had sort of worked out their difficulties, and this was probably the most successful time. This was in the 1780s up until the time of Sarah's death. And so it sort of was the full circle. And I think, of course, Sarah was always a reasonable person, and he didn't want to work not within the system of the Spanish government. I think they were all very disciplined and trained, and even though he would have preferred, you know, always his own way, he would not have been any type of a revolutionary person or gone against the wishes of the king. I think that's just within their training.
Dr. Iris Engstrand of the University of San Diego. By the way, many of Sarah's recommendations to the viceroy, which resulted from his disagreements with Pedro Fages, were incorporated into the first body of law for California, called the Echeveste Reglamento. The next disagreement mentioned, that with Rivera, who became Presidio commander in 1774, centered around Rivera's caution in his dealings with the Indians and hesitation to found new missions because he feared that this would spread out his manpower and weaken his position militarily. Sarah, on the other hand, was anxious to convert the Indians and found more missions. Sarah's zeal was in accordance with the desires of Viceroy Bucareli, but Rivera's caution was shown to have been well-founded when the Indians did rise in 1775 in the most serious act of rebellion against the missionaries here in San Diego. Claire, before actually discussing that rebellion, I'd like to ask if, on the whole, the Indians in San Diego were peaceful in their dealings with the missionaries.
Well, apparently they were. There was one initial attack very shortly after the first arrival in 1769, and that was punished. And then this large-scale attack was mounted in 1775. Estimates are that there were perhaps anywhere from 600 to 1,000 Indians who participated in that. But after that, the relationship between the Indians and the missionaries in San Diego and by and large throughout California was a peaceful one. There were no other large-scale attacks. Father Jaime is the only missionary to have been killed. That isn't to say that there weren't infractions of the rules and individuals who committed crimes, or many of them, of course, ran away. And this was also considered to be a crime and was punished. But there were no other organized group attacks on the mission system. It's another thing, of course, later on during the Mexican Ranchero era and in the American era, too. But the Indians were not primarily a warlike people. There certainly were individuals who rose up against the missionaries or took things or attacked and exhibited hostility, but no other large scale attacks besides this one in 1775.
Well, as you mentioned, one reason there were few organized attacks is that warfare was not an institution in the culture of the San Diego Indians. And there were other reasons pointed out here by Dr. Lucy Killay, the executive vice president of Fronteras de las Californias.
The Indians themselves were not organized. I think that was their main drawback in attempting to act against the Spanish, to them, invasion. They each lived in very small communities, and as they were brought into the missions, those communities were broken up so that they ended up with perfect strangers. The Spanish didn't look at it that way. The missionaries thought they were all Indians, didn't realize. But the very close family ties, so that also reduced their effectiveness in attempting to resist, because they were simply isolated from, very often, from their immediate members of their family. And there was very little effort, and I think it was because the Indians didn't know why the Spanish had come. They didn't realize that they were bringing a civilization that was to replace their own. If they had perhaps had a better idea of the motives of the Spanish, they perhaps would have, even to the point of desperation, resisted more strongly.
The pattern of peace was broken by the 1775 attack, and it may have been the Spanish lack of understanding of the native people that kept them from seeing that a rebellion was imminent.
I think it was the Spanish did not understand anything about the culture of the Indians. As I indicated, they really didn't think they had any in the sense that they were bringing civilization. So they really ignored, in large part out of ignorance, their structure of operating, the structure of their village structure, their family structure. They assumed that they, as savages, they did not have a religion, and they were giving them a religion. They simply were not aware of the fact that there might be some resistance there.